making soda bottle rockets, and growing plants off our planet. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. One commercial astronaut is helping kids build and launch their own rockets. For the second annual Baking Soda Rocket Day, Emily Calandrelli, known online as the Space Gal, is partnering with Arm & Hammer to help encourage kids to get excited about science, technology, engineering, art, and math, or STEAM. We'll get tips from Emily on how to maximize our own baking soda rocket and hear about her flight to space on Blue Origin's New Shepard. Then, as humans move towards exploring our moon and maybe even Mars someday, scientists are trying to figure out how we can live off of our planet long term. We'll speak with Florida Tech's Andrew Palmer about space agriculture. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? When Emily Calandrelli launched on Blue Origin's New Shepard spacecraft back in November 2024, she became the 100th woman to travel to space. Known as the Space Gal, Calandrelli has spent more than a decade as a science communicator, inspiring excitement in young people to explore science, technology, engineering, art, and math, or STEAM. Along with sharing her mission to space with the public, she's also inspiring curiosity here on Earth by building rockets. Emily is once again partnering with Arm & Hammer for the second annual Baking Soda Rocket Day. Across the country, 14,000 classrooms will be making rockets on October 9th. Here to talk about the global event and share some engineering tips on making our own baking soda and vinegar rockets is the Space Gal herself. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, so I've been following your career since I started reporting on this beat. You've been doing such exciting things, but really what's coming up now is this National Baking Soda Rocket Day. That sounds really cool. What is it?
Yeah, this is the second annual Baking Soda Rocket Day. We are going to break a record that we created ourselves last year, which is to launch the most baking soda rockets across the country in a single day. So this is a way for kids to build their own baking soda rockets with Arm & Hammer baking soda and really get hands-on experience with STEAM. And the goal is to inspire that science confidence in kids from a young age. And so I'm excited to come back a year later and almost a year after my own space flight. We're going to Queens, New York to a school there, and I'm going to help them launch their baking soda rockets.
You did not launch to space on a baking soda rocket though, right? It was a much different fuel.
No, but yeah, mine used a little bit of a different fuel for sure.
Baking soda rockets, I remember doing them in school. I mean, it is such a visual and physical representation of physics and science. And I know you spent the past few years as a science communicator really bringing these visual and hands-on science experiments to kids. Why is it so important to see the baking soda rocket take off and help explain science that way?
This is an easy enough science experiment that kids can build it with their own hands. They can put their own spin on it. And so these kids, they form teams, they create this rocket. And so it feels like they're becoming little scientists and little engineers in the process. They're thinking like them from a young age, and they create something that they're proud of. And then at the end, they literally launch a rocket that launches like 20, 30 feet in the air, which is a pretty cool payoff for any science experiment. It is just, it's one of the best hands-on science experiments that you can do with accessible materials.
As an engineer yourself, Emily, do you have any tips for building this baking soda rocket? How can I go to 30 or 40 feet?
So the experiment that you can do within the experiment is whether or not you choose a paper towel or a napkin or toilet paper to hold your Arm & Hammer baking soda. Because of course, the reaction is Arm & Hammer baking soda plus vinegar creates an acid-base chemical reaction that creates carbon dioxide bubbles. You put them all in a 2-liter bottle, you put a cork in the end. Those bubbles build and build and build and build, and eventually the cork can't take the pressure anymore. It shoots downward. All of that air moves downward. The rocket goes upward. The thing that you can do is if you use a paper towel, you make the reaction go slower because it takes longer for the vinegar to seep in. And because it goes slower, it allows more air to build up. So your rocket's going to go higher. The flip side of that is that it's going to take like 2 or 3 minutes to launch. But if you use the toilet paper, then it happens a lot faster. It'll launch within 5 to 10 seconds. It'll go up 10 to 15 feet in the air. So it's a little bit of a trade-off. Like, do you want your rocket to go fast and not quite as high? Or do you want to be patient, let it take a little while, and then go like 30 feet in the air?
demonstrations like this are coming to classrooms. All of this stuff is so much more accessible. I had to wait for Bill Nye or Beekman's World to come on TV. But now with some of the stuff that you're doing, kids have access to this on YouTube. Like, science is there for them, right?
It is. I mean, that's the beauty of the internet right now, is that science experiments are just a click away. I have 100 different science experiments in my books and on my YouTube channel that are all meant for families with kids ages 5 to 12. And a lot of them use materials that you have in your pantry right now. I have a whole playlist of science experiments that use Arm & Hammer baking soda, which is something that most families already have on hand. And so it's a really easy way for parents to introduce science to kids from a really young age.
As I mentioned, I have been following your career, and my goodness, it was so exciting to see you launch. And we actually had one of your crewmates is on our show quite often. Sharon Hagel is here quite a bit. So yes,
very cool.
She mentioned how much fun it was flying with you. But I want to hear from you. What was that moment like? Countdown hit zero, and that engine fired, and you went to space.
Oh my gosh, my heart was beating out of my chest. I have never been so scared in my life. I think a lot of people do this. And they're like, I've dreamt of this moment forever. No, I was terrified. I was very scared. When it launched, I think the awe took over the fear. And I just looked out the window and watched the earth fall away and the sky go from light blue to dark blue to black. And it was just the most magnificent feeling. Like, the overwhelming feeling that I had the entire time was gratitude. Like, I cannot believe I'm here. I cannot believe this is happening right now. Like, when you watch my video back, I keep saying, oh my gosh, I'm on a rocket. I'm on a rocket. And I just like keep saying these things that are happening because I can't believe it myself. And then when you finally see the Earth from that perspective, it's like nothing else. It is the most overwhelming sense of awe. And it was like, I've seen pictures of our planet before, but this is the first time I'm seeing it with my own eyes. And the only other time that I felt this sense of awe and wonder was when I literally gave birth to my children. That is the only time I felt that same feeling.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Emily Calandrelli about the second annual Baking Soda Rocket Day. Emily is a science communicator, author, host, and the 100th woman in space. She's known online as the Space Gal. It never gets old talking to people who have been to space and who do get to see our planet at a new perspective. It's called the overview effect, right? You know, did you feel that? Did you come back with a change in how you perceived who we are on this planet?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have an interesting opinion on the overview effect, because I think the vast majority of people who we've heard say that they've had the overview effect have been traditional astronauts. The overview effect has been well documented in NASA astronauts, and NASA astronauts historically had come from a military background, you know, had very similar backgrounds. And so they would come back and say, I saw the Earth with our paper thin atmosphere, and I cared more about the environment. And I saw our Earth without the boundaries that humans created, and it made me care more about our neighbor and our international partners. And for me, those were values that I already held before I went to space. So it was like, what is the overview effect for me? And I am still thinking through that, but I think the biggest takeaway that I had was that sense of wonder was something that I had felt as a mother. It was something that I think moms have felt for centuries. And it is the same wonder that we hold in our lives, in different parts of our lives. So it was something that for me was like very incredibly special and something I had felt before. And I think that makes me feel just more of a kindred with other moms who have felt that too.
That's such an interesting point, Emily, because yeah, there are now so many different people are getting the opportunity to go to space, not just these professionally trained astronauts, right? I mean, how do you think that is going to shape the way that we think about space exploration and travel when more and more people like yourself get to go?
I think right now it's going to be a bit of a struggle because we have typically only seen people who have been the cream of the crop, the top few percent of people in science and engineering go. And we've been trained to think that those are the only people who deserve to go. It has to be earned. And so when we see other people go in different ways, it challenges our worldview on who we think deserves to go. And now I think we're just going to be in that growing pain period where more and more people are going to be able to get that experience. And I think the beauty of that is that we have people from different backgrounds with different skill sets here on Earth that get to talk about it and reach different communities who have maybe never seen themselves in this field or doing something so extreme like that before. And I think it's going to make a whole lot of new people become big dreamers.
And for you being the 100th woman to go to space out of some 600, that shows that there is a gap when it comes to gender equality and space exploration. But I mean, how do you think that your milestone mission and the work you do inspiring young people, especially young girls, is going to help close that gap?
It's just really cool the way that my work reaches girls that have never felt included in other platforms. Like there's a wealth of very talented male science YouTubers out there that all of the girls who love Emily's Wonder Lab have never heard of. They just don't feel like their content resonates with them, but they loved Emily's Wonder Lab. And so when I went to space, it felt like I was bringing all of those girls with me to be like, you guys belong here too. And when I go into those classrooms for Baking Soda Rocket Day, I'm going to talk about my story. I'm going to talk about my space flight. And I'm excited to have that spark something inside them so that maybe they see a little bit of themselves in me and start thinking like, well, she accomplished her big dream. What's my big dream? What do I want to do?
Did you ever think at the onset that you would be traveling to space at all?
I mean, to be honest, I am delusional. Like I have always been somebody who has set like very silly, ridiculous high goals for myself and then pursue them relentlessly. You kind of have to be a little bit delusional to think that these types of goals are meant for you because so few people get them. And then it's only delusional until it comes true. So yeah, I think that I have thought that I was going to specifically go on a suborbital space flight since I was in grad school and I learned about the progress with Virgin Galactic. And I thought, this is going to probably be the way that I get to go to space because it just felt more accessible and it felt like someone like me could find a way because I'm very scrappy and I'm very persistent and I can be quite annoying when I want to be. I can find my way to a dream by being a bit persistent. And so, yeah, it was something that I had hoped for a very long time. I don't know that I actually thought that, you know, this is going to happen, but I had hoped that I would find a way.
Before I let you go, Emily, we've got the Arm & Hammer Baking Soda Project coming up. How can we participate if we're not at your school in New York?
Yes. So it's happening in 14,000 classrooms around the country, which is so cool. There are so many people that are participating in it, more so than last year. Anybody can go to bakingsodarocket.com to learn a little bit more. And one more cool thing to tie back into the Blue Origin of it all is that this year, Blue Origin is participating and giving students postcards that they can decorate and they will launch on a future New Shepard mission so that these kids who are participating in Baking Soda Rocket Day will also be able to walk away with something that they created that flew to space.
Very cool. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Emily Calandrelli, science communicator, who's also the 100th woman to travel to space, known online as the Space Gal. Still to come, space plants and how scientists are trying to grow food off of our planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Last year, NASA discovered what could be signs of ancient life on Mars. The agency says it's the closest it has come to finding life on Mars. We'll speak with NASA's head of science, Nikki Fox, about the implications of this finding and the work that needs to happen to confirm the finding is truly life on another world. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about how to have a green thumb in space. Plants are a necessity for human life. They provide food. And if we want to have longer missions or even a permanent residence off our planet, we have to figure out how to grow them in other environments, like those on the moon and even Mars. But how do we do that in places where there isn't water, or low gravity, or radiation levels that are really, really high? Well, working to answer those questions is Andrew Palmer. He's an associate professor of biology at the Florida Institute of Technology. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, so let's talk about your work and some of the things you do. You focus on growing plants in food, in space, and beyond. Let's first talk about what is so difficult about growing plants and food on other planets. I imagine it can't be that hard, right?
Well, so, you know, the Martian is a great inspiration for the work that we do, but really there's a lot of different challenges for growing crops in space, depending on where you are. So there's challenges on whether or not we're in low Earth orbit, so say on the International Space Station, whether we are on the moon or on Mars. And so some of those challenges include the difference in gravity. So, you know, plants have evolved in a 1G environment. And so we're not 100% sure how plants are handle microgravity. Well, we understand microgravity, but we don't understand necessarily how they're going to perform in the reduced gravities of the moon and Mars. So we're still trying to understand the properties of water in these environments. In fact, that's a big issue. We also have radiation. So how do we shield plants properly for the growth and the radiation? And then where we fit in a lot is just trying to understand how to provide nutrients to the crops that we're going to grow there. So transporting fertilizer is really going to be potentially expensive. So we look at ways to use the materials that are on the lunar surface or on the Martian surface and try and extract useful nutrients out of that so that we could actually make our own fertilizer once we're on site. And we have chemical and biological approaches that we think about in our lab for doing that.
Mark Watney, he provided his own fertilizer, didn't he, in the Martian?
Yeah.
Yep. So hopefully we don't have to do that when we go to places like Mars.
No.
Before we get into kind of the things that you are learning in your lab and the things that you are studying, I want to go and talk about why is this so important to understand? Are we really getting to a point where we're needing to have these conversations about how we can grow food and plants on another celestial body? Are we that close to doing it? And why is it important that we're able to grow food?
Sure. So I think from the standpoint of establishing a lunar settlement, I think that's really important. We want to have a sustainable presence on the moon, and that's going to require crop production. And so, yes, we can certainly bring prepackaged goods. The trip to the moon isn't going to take that long, but that ability to access fresh food is actually going to be really important both psychologically and from a human health standpoint. Many of the nutrients that astronauts or settlers are going to need on the lunar surface, they need access to fresh food that is going to have the nutrients that are not necessarily shelf stable. And there's also, again, the psychological benefit of being able to have something green, something that's part of our heritage, you know, from Earth to bring with us as we go abroad, right? Go beyond Earth. On Mars, the challenge is even more crucial. And so at best, right? So using Mark Watney as an example, if he had not been able to grow his own food, he would have starved. Right. And so it became absolutely crucial to be able to grow food when you're in an environment that's going to be 6 to 8 months away. There's no way around growing food on Mars. It's going to be an absolute necessity. And really, it's sort of a limiting component to any plan we make to establish a Martian settlement is we can't send people there and be unclear on how they're going to have access to fresh food, right? That can't be a concern. And so I think it's mission critical to do that on Mars. There's also a component of this where challenging ourselves to contemplate the agriculture of the future of lunar agriculture and Martian agriculture, it helps us turn our eye, and like NASA has always done, turn our eye to our own world and say, well, there's challenges for growing food here, and lessons that we learn about the challenges on Mars and on the moon, they help us figure out how to do better agriculture here on Earth.
Let's talk a bit about something that you mentioned earlier about finding a way to get fertilizer to grow this stuff. You're researching something called bioleaching. Can you tell me a bit about what that is and how that is going to help the Mark Watneys of the future grow their food without having to use solid waste?
Yeah. One of the things that we find both in the lunar surface and on the Martian surface is that a lot of the nutrients that plants actually need to grow, things like potassium and iron, they're there in different forms. And some of those, all we need to do is add some water and they'll come right out and dissolve into water and the plants can take them up. Others are what we call insoluble. So they need to be modified in a way in order to get those minerals to release those nutrients that the plants want to have. And so bioleaching is a way where we can bring in specific microorganisms, fungi, bacteria, that are able to basically perform that kind of chemistry or biochemistry to transform those minerals and leach that material out. We've actually been studying this off in different ways for a couple of years now. And we recently got some funding along with some collaborators at Winston-Salem State University, who's a longtime collaborator, Dr. Rafael Loreo, where we're actually going to get a chance to do this and see if we can take the material from, say, the lunar surface, leach those minerals out or weather those materials out biologically, and then apply them to plants. So can we use the surface of the moon to support a hydroponic system on the moon when settlers get there?
Fascinating. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Andrew Palmer. He's an associate professor of biology at the Florida Institute of Technology. We're talking about growing plants on other worlds. Andrew, you mentioned the chemical challenges and what you're hoping to do when it comes to growing plants, but there's also a structural challenge too, right? I mean, the regolith or dirt of the moon and Mars is very different than the soil we have here on Earth, right? What are some challenges that you run into with the actual dirt that you're growing these crops in?
So not only are there some challenges chemically with this material, there are definite mechanical challenges. And so you can think of these as being very clay-like. So as soon as you add water, they can fuse up and make almost like a cement. And so that is a real challenge because it essentially suffocates the roots of the plants. They can't get access to enough air. They can't really grow or penetrate the material. So it's actually very difficult to grow. We've been working along with other groups trying to find ways to basically improve the physical mechanical aspects of it. So some of the things we do is we add spacers. So like, you know, for any home gardeners, when you add like perlite or vermiculite, there are these sort of inert spacers that kind of give your soil some volume, right? Give it some lift. And so that's kind of one of the approaches we take. We also use bacteria that can actually coat the material, the Martian soil or the lunar soil, and make it have those same kind of properties. It makes it more fluffy, improves the volume, improves what we call wettability, or basically how well it absorbs water. And so we're working on these physical parameters along with just trying to make it better substrate for growth.
Wettability. What a great word.
Yeah. That's so, you know, as I actually am originally a chemist by training, and I get really interested in biology. So that's like all of the chemistry I like is biological chemistry. And now we've moved into this very exciting soil area, which I think is just learning a lot, so much about soil science and ecology and geology. You know, I was laughing with one of my colleagues that we had an hour long debate about what the definition of dirt was. and at the end of it, we were just sort of like, well, we'll agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. And I just find that really, this is such a spectacular field to get into now.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. You mentioned those spacers that are there to kind of break up, making this almost clay or cement-like. One of the things that you all are testing in your lab is using peanut shells to do this, right? Does that kind of take the place of some of these other fillers you were talking about?
Yeah, actually. So that was a great project started by one of the undergraduate students here. So Trent was growing these peanuts in the regolith material that we used to simulate the surface of Mars in this case. And then he would take that material and grind up the shells and put them back in, and actually showed that he could improve a lot of the mechanical characteristics of the simulants and make them better for plant growth. And he actually now is growing in, we have offsite lab that's all artificial lighting, all artificial environmental controls. And he's growing a very large bags of peanuts. And now he's trying to grow a much larger data set. So we've got a big field growing out there right now.
I mean, that points to, you know, using what you have, right? So you don't have to bring so much stuff with you. That's in situ resource utilization, right? You're using what you have there to make it work. That's really cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of our big focus is, you know, we refer to the work we do as sustainable space agriculture, looking at how much can we leverage from the on-site resources to basically make life a little bit easier and ensure that food security and food safety when our settlers arrive on these locations.
This question comes from my producer, Marion Summerall, who has a peanut allergy. would that affect anything? Is she not going to be able to go to Mars and eat any of the crops that are grown in this peanut regolith?
So the peanuts are a proof of concept.
Okay.
So, we're looking at similar ideas where we can take the parts of the plant that we don't eat and can we incorporate them into another mechanism? So actually, I have another student who's working on using what we call the inedible biomass, or the stuff you can't eat. And she's actually using it as food for oyster mushrooms. And so we're basically closing part of that loop in the habitat by saying, okay, we'll take the parts of like a tomato plant that you can't eat, and we'll use that to grow mushrooms that then you can put on some other food, right? So we can supplement our food budget that way.
I was hoping the answer was she couldn't go to Mars because I need her to work on this show. So, finally, Andrew, you mentioned you're trying all these proof of concepts, you're growing stuff here. How do you actually accomplish growing this stuff and mimicking the environments that these plants will be growing in? How do you mimic the environment of the moon and Mars here on Earth to say that, hey, this might work?
You know, the first thing is it's important to understand that we're not going to be growing out on the surface of Mars, even though there is an atmosphere there. It's way too thin and it's not going to be suitable. So, we're going to be working in these controlled environmental chambers and conditions, right? So a habitat. So we do a lot of work with all artificial lighting. So we have a couple of different facilities, tents and rooms where all the lighting is artificial. The seeds that we germinate in there and grow there all the way to, their next generation have never seen daylight. So they've only seen artificial lighting. We use these simulants that are made out of Earth proxies of the lunar surface or the Martian surface. And so those mimic mineralogically and mechanically what growing on those surfaces will be like. And then, we think about that in that context, right? So we're dealing with an artificial environmental chamber, and then we're dealing with these simulants. And we're constantly refining how much the simulants actually look like the surfaces that we want to end up landing on, right? So I think there's a constant dialogue between the research community that are using these simulants and the producers of the simulants themselves.
Fascinating conversation. Andrew, if you need a taste tester, you know where to find me. I'm happy to come out there and try some of the stuff that you've grown. Andrew.
Pretty tasty.
I'm sure it is. Andrew Palmer is an associate professor of biology at the Florida Institute of Technology. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is at @AWTY_. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might make a great guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our director of audio is Brad Waldo. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.